Yeah, when Shantavadri asked me to give this talk, I was really pleased because I thought it's such a good subject to think about, to reflect on, to engage with. It's one of those things you can't easily ignore in many ways. And this phrase, practice dying, came to mind straight away. And it's been in my mind for a number of years as a kind of like one of those little kind of homilies, you know, that sort of encourages you to kind of get on with things, really. And but I looked it up on the internet, and I was a bit surprised to find that it didn't come from the Buddhist tradition. I thought it was some great Buddhist master who had kind of come up with this particular motto. I even thought it may have been one of the teachers that Sangharakshita had when he was in Kalimpong. But actually, it's a quote from Plato, and he was writing about the life of Socrates. And apparently, he asked Socrates, he was a pupil of Socrates, and he asked Socrates, you know, what advice would he give to anyone who wanted to follow the philosophical path, the path of investigation, which in those days was actually quite a spiritual kind of enterprise in ancient Greek times. And Socrates came up with this motto, practice dying. So that's where it comes from. But I've noticed it's been appropriated by quite a lot of different traditions, not just Buddhism, but also actually Christian tradition too. And there was some other weird sect that I don't quite understand that seemed to be referring to practicing dying on the internet. But then that's the internet for you. So this weekend has been focused particularly on looking at physical death. You've been looking at the inevitability of death and the uncertainty around that. We don't know when it's going to happen, we don't know how it's going to happen. And then you've been looking at the other three reminders, which, if I can read my writing, the preciousness of the human life, the defects of samsara, and actions having consequences, the law of karma. And I think that all these three really are just ways of encouraging us to practice dying. And they're very much an urge to practice right now, right here, today, this very moment. So in a way you could say it's all about bringing alive the practice of spiritual death. And I know that this year is the year of spiritual death at the LBC. Last weekend I discovered that you've actually been doing quite a lot of work on this. There have been all sorts of courses and talks. And I was listening to Jan of Archer's talk that he gave at the beginning of the year, just a few weeks ago it must have been. And found that he was actually saying quite a few things that I wanted to say. So that's quite good, because that means that I'm freed up to say other things and perhaps take what he said a little bit further and even experiment a little bit, try something a bit different. But the nub of his talk was that one of the key elements in the spiritual life, in Buddhist tradition, is the transition from death to rebirth. It's a transformation of the consciousness. And the focus on physical death is simply one example of how that happens. And looking at that is one way of really bringing us to the sharp end of what spiritual death is about. Broadly speaking, and to probably paraphrase Jan of Archer, but I don't think this can be said too often, because this is just so much the kind. This is really the nub of why we're Buddhist. It's certainly the nub of why I'm a Buddhist. What it's about is transforming our consciousness. We, in our sort of normal everyday existence, the world in general, tends to relate to experience and to things, to everything we encounter, in fact, from the point of view of things being fixed, and from the point of view of a self. So it's, you know, sometimes it's called the ego, but I'm not sure, I think that's rather a psychological term. But certainly, when you start to examine how you experience and relate to the world, it's very much in terms of things being fixed, and it's very much in terms of self-reference. And in Buddhism, the important thing, what we're trying to do, is shift that consciousness, shift that kind of way of seeing things, to experiencing life as an unbounded process, so that it's unbounded in the sense that the self is really just a notional, it's a notional term, but it doesn't actually reflect reality. Reality is unbounded. There aren't limits, and there isn't a distinction between self and others. It's also ever-changing. And it's ever-changing, and the more you examine this, the more you find that it's ever-changing, ever more profoundly, nothing at all. Even though it might appear to us to be solid, like this wall, like this table, or even like a mountain, actually, if you shift the perspective, you'll discover that it's just a process. And when you start seeing things as process, they begin to lose their sort of substantiality. They become something really quite sort of ethereal. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to change, we're trying to move our consciousness from the fixed self view to seeing life, experiencing life as an unbounded process. And we don't distinguish between self and other at any level, in any kind of way. But this transition isn't easy. It's frightening. It can be frightening. It's certainly unnerving. There's a sense of having the ground disappearing from under your feet. There's an element of the unknown, because we're moving from something that we know and that we're trying to establish ourselves in, literally to stand in, to something that we really don't have much idea about. I'm just thinking of one example of how unnerving this is. I think for me, I was thinking about what sort of examples have I got in my life of spiritual death? And actually the first thing I came up with was something that happened before I even became a Buddhist, before I even encountered Buddhism, I think. It's probably a little bit before then. And at that time I was a bit of a brash, kind of self-confident youth in some ways. Self-confidence certainly in my ideas. And I was having discussion with a sort of friend. She was really a friend of a friend. And we were talking about art, and we were talking about a painter, an Italian painter called Di Chirico. And as we were talking, I insisted that this artist should be pronounced, and it should be pronounced as I've seen it written in English, which is Di Chirico. That actually the H was there, and it should be Di Chirico. And I was getting quite sort of insistent about this. And she looked at me, and she said, in a very strong Italian accent, because she was Italian, "No, it's Di Chirico, and I'm Italian, and I think I should know." And it was so humiliating. I mean, it really was humiliating. I got so carried away with my own kind of sense of who I was and what I knew, that I actually hadn't kind of cottoned on that I was speaking to an Italian person. I really wished the ground had opened up beneath my feet. I'm glad to say that I did take it on the chin, but it stayed. The memory of that humiliation has stayed with me ever since, and I don't ever want to repeat it again. So I'm much more careful now. I think some people say think I'm still a bit, I could be a bit dogmatic or insistent, but I'm much better than I used to be, I can tell you. So, when we're thinking about sort of dying to this experience of a fixed self-view and all the things that we hold on to in relation to that, we actually need to have something, some idea of moving towards something. Otherwise, we're not going to be interested in doing that. It's just going to be too scary. it's just going to be falling down, like falling down a deep, dark hole, which may well be bottomless. So this is where I'm going to start. I want to try something out with you all, actually. And I don't know if it's going to work or not, but we'll see. So what I'd like you to do is to consider five metaphors, which are very commonly used in Buddhism. Now, one way of talking about Buddhism and the idea of enlightenment, this shift in consciousness, in fact, which is what enlightenment is, in essence, there's a sense of there's an emphasis on freedom, which is quite a nice idea. I mean, it's one of those words that's bandied around and is often misused. So it's one of those words that you really have to sort of define to some degree. And what I'm going to do is just give you a list of different kinds of freedom. And what I'd like you to do is just listen to them. And if any of these particularly strike you as, that's how I'd like my life to be, I'd like it to be free from this, then just remember that through the rest of the talk. And I'm going to come back to it later and just see how it fits in. So these are the metaphors of freedom or liberation in the Buddhist tradition, or some of the metaphors. I mean, there's actually, I think, something like 75 metaphors for enlightenment, so there's a long, long list. So one thing is freedom from illness. And then freedom from slavery. Freedom from debt. And then, well, in the tradition, it's a safe crossing through a desert. I think for us, we don't have much experience of deserts. But perhaps you could imagine going through a rather dangerous part of town or New York or something, and managing to negotiate that so safely and arriving at the other end, and you're still intact, and you've still got all your facilities. You've managed to make this tricky, dangerous journey and arrive safely. And then the final one is freedom from prison. So if you think any of those particularly apply to you, they sort of strike a chord. That's how as a metaphor for how you'd like your life to be. Just remember that. So I was thinking about my own experiences of sort of meeting death, both spiritual and otherwise. I realised that there's actually, I thought there were actually two sort of useful kind of dimensions with which one could look at one's experience or one's attitude to death. So I'm just going to go through those. And I'm going to mainly refer to my own experience of my parents' death. My parents both died within 6 months of each other, 5 years ago. So as you can imagine, that was quite a strong thing to happen. And in thinking about it, there were sort of four aspects and two dimensions. So the first thing was the unexpectedness, the unpreparedness. I was really not prepared. When my dad died in May, I was actually about to move from where I was living, and it wasn't an easy move. I was not really wanting to go, but I needed to for various reasons. Obviously, I can't go into the details, but I was struggling psychologically with that move. It was quite a challenge to make that move. And then I got a phone call from my mum to say my dad had gone into hospital, and she didn't think that he would survive. That he would come back, is what she said. And she told me what the diagnosis was, and I thought, this is serious. In fact, by the time I got down to my parents' house in Devon from Croydon, where I was living, my dad had actually died. He died on the journey. And I got a text from my brother to tell me that. So that was really quite relatively out of the blue. I mean, he was quite old. He was in his 80s. So there was a sense of shock in that. So that's the unexpected element. That's an example of the unexpected element. But then there's also the expected. It wasn't altogether unexpected. My dad had been really for a number of years not very happy. He was getting more infirm. He was unable to walk very easily. Unfortunately, he'd sort of sunk into alcoholism. It's not something, fortunately, as a kid, he was prone to. But I think just as he got older, all the different factors in his life, you know, he was a bit bored. He wasn't terribly happy with himself and the world. And too much time and money just meant that he slipped into this sort of stage of alcoholism for the last 5 years of his life. And he was very difficult to be around. So I think he was aware that he was not really making life comfortable for anyone around him, and particularly my mother. And on a number of occasions he sort of voiced the view that you know, he'd had enough, really. So I wasn't altogether surprised. And I wasn't altogether surprised when my mum died 6 months later. Because she'd been ailing for a number of years with what transpired to be heart problems. And she was, because of that, her mind was beginning to get a bit loose. It was a bit like talking to, well, if you've ever smoked any marijuana, it was a bit like talking to someone who was on marijuana some of the time. She'd sort of drift in and out of awareness. With her, there was a sense of, well, partly, you know, my dad had died, and I think the two had been sort of competing with each other to stay on the longest. And they put it in terms of supporting each other, actually. It was quite sweet. But I think she sort of gave, you know, when my dad died, as often happens, she gave up, really. So her death was not really unexpected. She died just a few days after she'd got all my brothers, there's four of us, and we'd all come down to see her, so she'd seen us all together. And I think that was all she needed, really. And in fact, the morning she died, she woke up, and about an hour before she had a heart attack, she said, "Oh, am I still here?" It wasn't unexpected that she did die. The other dimension, so that's the unexpected, expected dimension. The other dimension is the unwelcome and the welcome. So the unwelcome aspect, well, that's what we often meet first and is most strong within us, is that we meet death, we don't welcome it. It's a challenge. I mean, when my parents died, there was particularly, I think, there were all sorts of unconscious things that went on. It's very hard. I think the death of a parent is a very strong experience, and things happen at very different levels. And I entered a period of a number of years when life was a lot more difficult. I found it very difficult, for example, to get things completed. I went through a phase of a certain amount of rage, not particularly with my parents, but just generally at the world. There was a lot of turmoil, internal turmoil. And the process of grieving, which is a natural process, is quite tough. It can be quite tough. I think for all of us it's not easy. For some people it can be really, really, really difficult. I was fortunate that I didn't have to be working, so I could sort of hide away when I really didn't feel like relating to people, or just felt that I would do damage. But that experience, I must say, I didn't particularly welcome, even though it was necessary. And then there's the welcoming death. On the other hand, with my parents, I was quite relieved that they died. Both of them for different reasons. My dad, because he was a bit fed up. my mum, because we were really worried about looking after her. She'd got to the point where she couldn't climb stairs. And she was quite a proud woman, and I think her sense of dignity was quite challenged by her need to be dependent on others. And she found that very difficult. We were all quite concerned as to how we would manage to look after her properly and well. We all lived quite some distance from her. So we'd actually got in a full-time carer for her, but it felt very, you know, it just didn't fit really. So there was a sort of sense of timeliness, I think, and a sort of, for me, well, it was relief, actually. And a bit with my dad too, I must say, because he had been very, very difficult. His alcoholism had sort of taken him over. And I really found it a challenge to be with him and engage in conversation with him. And also, I mean, rather more self-interestedly, because my parents had a house that was worth some money, I've actually inherited some money, and that's why I don't have to work at the moment. And that was it's a real privilege to have that ability, that, you know, to have that my financial needs met. So I can actually do things that I feel I want to do. In spite of what Shanta Vedra said, I don't know how wisely I use my time, but I do my best. So we have the unexpected and the expected dimension of death, and we have the unwelcome and the welcome dimension of death. And just focusing a bit more on the unwelcome, I think there's another way of looking at this. I've noticed that most people, nearly everyone, has a particular fear of dying a particular way. In my case, it's heights. I think that's the thing that has always, as a kid, I was always terrified of heights. I remember even from the age of about 4, being in situations where I would refuse to go anywhere near a sort of vertical drop. But for other people, it's different things. Some people are frightened of drowning. Some people are frightened of destitution. That was actually something that came up for me when my parents died. It was quite interesting. I've been quite bold in my life financially, as Shanta Vedra sort of pointed out. And it was a new one for me to find myself scared of destitution. But we do carry with us these kind of fears of particular ways of dying, and I think what's really interesting about them is that they are metaphors in some way for how we see death and what it is that we resist in death. So it's worth investigating and actually engaging with those kind of fears. I gave quite a bit of attention to this, and I remember on one, I think it was on retreat at Vajraloka, it sort of dawned on me that what one way I could look at this fear of heights was to see it as a metaphor for life, and that life is like jumping off a cliff and falling down, and there's no way you're not going to hit the bottom. There's an inevitability about it. And I didn't want to hit the bottom. That's what scared me, hitting the bottom. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So I thought, well, actually, the metaphor for me is to see that as a way of... What I found myself saying to myself, what I want to do is learn to fly before I hit the bottom. So I never actually experienced that death in that kind of way. And that's something I've sort of tried to carry with me as much as I can. So in a way, you know, I could say that my spiritual life is learning to fly before I hit the bottom. And I'm running out of time. So in engaging with spiritual death, we're talking about letting go of the things we cling on to. We're talking about letting go of the things that we think we can rely on, but Buddhism tells us we can't. And the number of these things that we hold on to are legion. I can't even begin to engage with them and say very much about them. So what we need to be doing is trying to approach these inevitabilities, these unsatisfactorinesses, oh, that's a new word, these things that don't really work, in ways that changes our relationship to them. And I think we can see that as being a move from things being unexpected to things being expected. Now, there is an uncertainty about this, so I think perhaps I would change that to unexpected and expected, rather more to prepared and unprepared. So we're normally unprepared, and we need to move toward being prepared. We can be prepared for the unexpected. I think that's really an important message in Buddhism. You never quite know what's around the corner. And that openness is a kind of key thing to kind of be working on cultivating. So we can move from being unprepared, things being sudden, in the sense that we're completely thrown, to being prepared, so that whatever our experience throws at us, whatever the world lays on our doorstep or chucks at us, we can meet it in some way. We've got some kind of means to kind of approach it and work with it. And I think that's one of the things for me that really fuels my commitment to Buddhism. It's this idea that I think I've felt for a long time that whatever happens, Buddhism has always given me some way of approaching it or engaging with it that is helpful, that I can make use of it in some way, rather than be overwhelmed or destroyed by it. So we need, in order to sort of prepare to welcome in spiritual death and physical death, we need to practice. We need to practice continually. We need to continually practice dying to permanence and self-cherishing, holding on to permanence, holding on to self-cherishing. And by practicing this, it enables us to face death, both personal and both physical and spiritual, when it happens. And to practice it, we need to invite it in. We need to do things that bring us closer to it. Just meditating is a very good start. You're sitting there on the cushion and there's not really much to do except follow your breath if you're doing the mindfulness of breathing. And probably for most of you found when you started meditating that all sorts of things get thrown up that you didn't know were there. And sometimes they can be pleasant, and sometimes they can be unpleasant and difficult. And you quite often, we never realise that they were there. So just meditating itself is an invitation to the beginnings of spiritual death. Because who and what we thought we were, we discover isn't the case. We can seek it out, we can actively seek it out. We could make more of a commitment to the spiritual life. We could become a mitra. I believe some of you tonight are going to be made mitras. I think becoming a mitra is a very big step, because in some ways I think that it's more important than becoming an order member. Because I think when you become a mitra, when you become a friend, you're explicitly stating that you are a Buddhist. I mean, for me, it felt a bit like that. In some ways, becoming an order member was an inevitable consequence of declaring that I was a Buddhist. But it was that declaration, perhaps because I'm the sort of person who tends to hold things in a bit and not kind of be very public about things I can feel strongly about. Particularly something like that, something quite personal. To actually declare myself a Buddhist and to go to friends and family and say, you know, I'm involved with this movement, and to actually talk about it was the biggest step of commitment I think I made, and everything followed from that. So I was sort of seeking out, I was actually inviting people to respond to that. I wasn't keeping it hidden. And we can also turn towards things when they happen. When death presents itself to us, we can turn towards it. A sort of example I can think of in our sort of more everyday experience is Perhaps a difficult communication. You're talking to someone, a friend or a colleague, and you get into a difficult kind of engagement, and they say something that upsets you. Well, there's two ways you can react to that. You can try to push it away, push them away, or you can actually turn into that situation and you can make something of it. It may be that you learn something about you. In fact, inevitably, particularly if you're a bit scared of it, you'll learn something about yourself. But you may also, and it may not be bad. I think often our avoidance of difficult communication is one of those things that tends to make us feel, maybe I'm just talking personally, but it tends to make us feel a bit impotent. We're a bit at the mercy of other people and the world. And actually speaking out and engaging directly with someone who's upset you, I've found gives me a sense of I've sort of regained some kind of potency and ability to work with what's there and not be kind of overwhelmed and put down by it. I'm going to come back to this in a minute. So we can invite in death, we can seek it out, and we can turn towards it. And it's in the... We can do this all the time. We're faced with these little challenges when we start looking for them, in all the little details of our lives. Recently, the possibility of working as a secretary for Sangharakshita came up. And I'm quite sort of... I taught myself to touch type some years ago, and I'm quite proud of the fact that I can do that, I suppose. I thought, well, I need to brush up on my typing. And I started to do that. I just got some exercises and started to do them. And I just discovered that there was whole areas of touch typing I hadn't got a clue about. I'd forgotten about all the symbols. My numbers use was not very good at all. And I've had to go through a process of relearning how to type, really. And that's meant going through a period when it just all completely fell apart. I'd sit down to do these exercises, and I couldn't get anything right. You know, I was just constantly hitting the wrong key. Even the ones that I was familiar with, I was hitting the wrong ones. I mean, this is a sort of everyday experience when we're learning skills, actually. You go through phases where it just goes pear-shaped. But what I noticed was just how I resisted that. I got irritable. I tried to cut corners. And all these things were coming back at me just from this simple practice of learning to type a bit more carefully, a bit more skillfully, a bit more competently. And I could see that these things were actually getting in the way of my capacity to be more capable at typing. Because I was just, you know, when I got angry, then I just didn't want to do it. So I'd go off and have a cup of tea, you know, or do another exercise that was easier. And I continually, my hands were so trained to cut corners that they were constantly disobeying, you know, they were kind of moving in the wrong direction because, and I'd be looking at the keyboard, you know, it's a classic thing. I'd sort of cut corners by looking at the keyboard. And it was really, it's really, I mean, I'm a bit shocked in a way, I'm a bit ashamed at how much I've seen in all of this, and it's been a slightly humiliating to see what my habits have been, really. And this is just from learning to type, so... You know, fortunately no one was around and I've just managed to live with that and I'm getting better now. I had a go this morning and I was doing quite well really, so I've moved on. So I wanted to spend a bit more time focusing on how we avoid meeting death. And I'm going to try something out. I don't know if anyone has thought about this before. It may be new, it may not. I mean, knowing the London Buddhist Centre, you guys tends to be quite ahead of the game in a lot of things, so it may well be that this has already been suggested. But in the Buddhist tradition, in meditation, one of the things that we teach in terms of dealing with meditation, when quite often when you come along to courses and you're taught the basic practices, and then you're taught how to deal with the things that get thrown up, that get in the way. And this is the teaching of the five hindrances. When I started to engage with the hindrances, it struck me that they they're not actually just about meditation. They're not just the things that get in the way of our meditation. They're actually the things that get in the way of our lives. You know, the five hindrances are always with us, whether we're on the meditation cushion or not. And I actually think that, I mean, unfortunately, I believe that insofar as I'm in touch with the broader movement, I kind of get a sense that the teaching of the five hindrances has slightly fallen by the wayside. Some people have found it a bit challenging. A bit difficult seems to get in the way of meditating because we can give ourselves a hard time. But I think that if you can start thinking of the five hindrances in relation to your life as a whole, there's a lot to be learnt from that. It's well documented. As a teaching, it's very well documented. We've got Kamala Shila, one of our own order members, has written this book on meditation. There's a lot in there about the five hindrances, so like a chart with all the different sort of aspects of it, which I can't go into now. I'm only going to just touch on some of these. And there's also Anaglio's book, Satipatthana, which is looking at mindfulness practice in real depth. And they both explore the five hindrances. Now, Anaglio says something very interesting, which really jumped out at me when I read it. He said that in the Buddhist sutras, in the Buddhist scriptures, the five hindrances only present themselves in the context of what we call stream entry. Now, this is the period of the point of transition between our lives being self-referential and fixed to our lives becoming focused on process, other-regarding and unbounded. So that actually these five hindrances are the hindrances to us making this transition in our consciousness. So they're much more important than simply how we get on in meditation. Of course, they'll present themselves in meditation because that's what we're doing at that time. But these are life patterns. The hindrances are our life patterns. And I think we could usefully look at our lives in terms of the hindrances. If we want to make spiritual progress as Buddhists, then looking at our life patterns in terms of the hindrances could be very useful. So I'm going to go through a little bit. I'm going to go through each hindrance in turn. Just make one reference to one suggestion as to how that expresses itself in our lives, and just say a little bit more. So the first hindrance is aversion, or ill will. Actually, I don't have to say much about this, because Jnanavacha mentioned this in his talk. And he talked about the fact that we blame people for what happens, and that we need to practice forgiveness. So aversion or ill will. So when we're faced with something that we don't want to hear or see, when we're faced with a spiritual death, we respond with aversion. We can blame. I'm now going to come back to those list of freedoms that I gave you and just relate each freedom to a particular hindrance, see what you make of it. And I don't know if this will happen, but what I'm interested to see is if you start thinking about what you have a sense of freedom about, which of these freedoms appeal to you, you might start to see that the hindrance, you can see how that manifests in your life. It may be that for you, that's your prevalent hindrance. I think we all experience the hindrances at all the time to some degree. But we do, you know, as individuals, we tend to have our kind of our favourites, so to speak. The mind, you know, the mind has its own favourites. So freedom from ill will is like recovering from illness. It's freedom from illness. It's good health. And then the second hindrance is restlessness and anxiety. And I think that expresses itself in the modern world very strongly indeed. Particularly as busyness. The modern world is one of those, it offers us plenty of opportunities to be really, really busy. It actually demands it of us, and it's quite difficult not to be busy. But that busyness just keeps our mind racing, and we're never able to stop and actually measure and take a stock of what's going on. And we can become quite addicted to this. And I think the freedom, this is a very interesting one, I think, the freedom that's related to restlessness and anxiety is slavery. So we're actually slaves to our busyness. I think that's really worth thinking about. Are you a slave to your busyness? It's a good question to ask. What happens when you're busy? What happens when you suddenly stop? Do you suddenly find you're getting anxious because you need to be doing something? Can you sit with yourself with nothing to do for 10 minutes, half an hour, a day? What's that feel like? Is it really uncomfortable? And, of course, a simple solution to this is to simplify our lives. So there are things we can do. We can just simplify our lives. The third hindrance is sense desire, stimulation. It's quite closely related, I think, to restlessness and anxiety. These hindrances tend to sort of merge into each other. They're not that distinct, I find, in my own experience. And again, modern life is just rich with opportunities to stimulate ourselves. Of course, there are all the kind of various chemical things that we can imbibe. Smoking, drinking, coffee, drugs. But there's also input. Incredible amount of information input. We're completely overloaded with input. And we continually seek it out. There's films, there's TV, there's the internet, there's music. There's just no end to it. As soon as one thing stops stimulating you, you can turn to something else. You know, I've lived with people who've, you know, had the TV on, been listening to the radio, and also having music playing in the background while trying to hold a conversation. That's as far as, you know, can get that extreme. And you find this happening all the time in the modern world. You know, you're walking down the street, and a lot of people are talking into their mobile phones. You know, they're like mad people, because they're not actually engaged with what's going on, because they're actually having a conversation, a row maybe with someone, or negotiating some business deal. And they're not taking what's going on around them. So they're just kind of dealing with it, and yet they have to sort of find their way through the crowds and, you know, down to the tube or whatever they're doing, or even when they're driving. So we're just kind of seeking out this sense desire. And again, there's a sort of element of compulsion about this, I think, for many people. And the freedom of it from this is the freedom from debt. Again, it's really interesting to just reflect on what does it feel like? You know, you've got a big debt and suddenly you're released from that. And we're prisoners to, you know, being the prisoner of sense desire is like being the prisoner of debt. And the antidote, of course, is quite obvious. It's just to reduce input. Just do one thing at a time. To just cut down, really. The fourth hindrance is doubt and indecision. I'm starting to enter in. I mean, these are things I haven't worked out very thoroughly, and it may be a bit clunky. It feels a little bit clunky to me. But I think there's mileage in this, so I want to kind of take it further, really. But I think doubt and indecision, one way in which it manifests itself is in authority problems. I think one of the things I've come across quite a lot in the movement is difficulty, people having difficulty with being told what to do, or thinking they're being told what to do. It can really get in the way of our spiritual practice. Now, obviously, one has to be wise and not foolish and gullible. But this has sort of become almost a mantra. I think it's become a sort of mantra for us to stand on our own and be individualistic. And to not actually be able to not be receptive to wisdom. And if you're not receptive to wisdom, you're in big difficulty when it comes to practicing as a Buddhist. And these authority problems can just throw themselves up all the time in different situations. Ratna Ghosha, who used to be chairman here, gave a talk some years ago on the precepts, on the ethical precepts. And he was saying, well, this is, you know, if you want to practice as a Buddhist, this is what you should do and this is what you shouldn't do. So he was being quite clear, quite explicit. And then about halfway through, he said, and if you think I'm telling you what to do, you've got an authority problem. Because, as he said, I'm just telling you this is what Buddhism says. Whether you do it or not is up to you. I can't make you do it. I don't have any power over you. You're free to choose whether to follow what I'm suggesting or not. And freedom from doubt and indecision is a safe crossing. So the doubt and indecision is a dangerous path, if you like. It's a dangerous journey, and to be free from that is to get to the end of that journey and to find yourself in safety, a sense of knowing where you are. I think actually this is what I'm talking about for me, and what Buddhism offers for me in terms of always giving me something that I can work with, something helpful to do, whatever the world throws at me. It's a bit like that's the end of the journey. It's the end of the dangerous journey, because I can trust Buddhism. I'm not sure I can trust my practice of Buddhism because I'm not wise enough to understand it fully. But I know that somewhere in there there are solutions, there are answers, there are ways forward. And finally, we have sloth and torpor. This one was a bit tricky to think of clear-cut examples. I think in many ways depression is a kind of response, is one particular expression of sloth and torpor, but I don't want to go into that very much now. And I have experienced depression in my life, particularly as a teenager, and it was quite a strong experience. But what I think is quite interesting to look at is there's other ways in which we can be slothful. We can be slothful by being quite busy. I think one way we can be slothful is by having very strong views about how things are. And the reason that's slothful is because we're being quite lazy, I think. We want to know what's happening. We want to know what is and what isn't. And if we know what is and what isn't, we don't have to think about it anymore. We don't have to engage with it. And for me, this is a kind of slothfulness. This is a kind of laziness. And I think holding strongly to our views, and I'm not talking about having views. I mean, in Buddhism, we talk about right views and wrong views. Views are important. It's rather more how we communicate them, how we feel about them, how we're attached to them. If we find our views challenged, what goes on inside us? A few weeks ago, I was sitting with a couple of friends, and we were planning a introductory weekend at Rivendell. And one of them said, "Oh, I think the Queen's marvellous. I think she's fantastic. What a wonderful person." And suddenly, in me, all these views came to the surface, and I really wanted to challenge. I found myself thinking, "I like this person. How can I like this person? What a, you know, I have quite a strong Republican kind of left-wing tradition in my life, and for me, of course, royalty represents something that is to be kind of questioned quite strongly, to say the least. And it's not about the Queen being a nice person or not. It's something about how that's used, if you like. Something about the institution, if you like, of royalty. And I really had to be careful, because I just found myself wanting to say all these. I really wanted to challenge her and sort of really kind of have a go at these kind of views that she had. And it was quite a lot. I really felt strongly. It felt important to me that people shouldn't think like that, particularly not her. You know, she's a good friend. How could you be so foolish, you know? How could I be friends with someone who thinks the Queen is marvellous? Fortunately, I did manage to just hold back. And it's been quite an interesting experience working with that one, actually. And someone said something the other day that I thought summed it up, really. That there's actually, within that, there's something very interesting. It's like, I could actually, instead of bothering about my views, it's a way to understand how my friend thinks. So what is it about the Queen that is so, for her, represents something really positive? What are the positive things that she sees? I bet if I explored it that way, we never got around to doing that. I mean, we had to talk about other things. I changed the subject, actually. But actually, going into that with her, I think I would have just found out more about who she was and what was important to her. And I think I would have just got to know her better and got to appreciate her more as well. So, this is another interesting one, the freedom. The freedom from sloth and torpor is actually is the freedom from prison. So our views, holding on to our views, keeps us in a kind of prison. Again, I find that quite a strong metaphor. That's a quick run through the hindrances. As I say, there's a very rich tradition in looking at the hindrances, and I'm just giving you a hint of it, a taster, that I hope will kind of spark you to explore this further. And in the way that hindrances are documented, what's very helpful is that it's not just that you're given these list of things, but there's quite a rich documentation of how to work with them, how to transform them, and how to change them. For each hindrance, there's actually five approaches you can take. I'll just list them, just don't try and remember this, of course, but just to let you know. So you can suppress it. You can just go, don't want that. You can work outside of the situation. Traditionally, in meditation, this is considered. It's a bit like setting up the conditions where the particular hindrance doesn't manifest so much. I'm afraid I haven't got time to explain further on this. You can also cultivate the opposite. For example, with sense desire in the Buddhist tradition, meditation on the decomposition of the corpse, which is quite a strong way of doing it, you could do that. So there are antidotes. But I just want to mention the last two, which are considering that particular hindrance. What are the effects of that hindrance? What does it feel like? What does it feel like for me? What are the consequences for myself and for other people? And the other one is the sky-like mind. This is a wonderful image in Buddhism. It's one of those images that sort of encapsulates so much. The sky-like mind is, I think, in this context, is about openness and receptivity. The sky-like mind is so big that whatever presents itself can just be there. It's a bit like the phenomena that appear in the sky-like mind are said to be like clouds that come and go, so that you're so big you're like the sky in this imaginative experience, and whatever comes up are these little clouds, so that we're not caught up in them. The key thing in terms of the hindrances, we realise that we're much bigger than whatever it is we're caught up in, so we don't get so bound up with our attachments to what's happening. And actually, I think that a combination of the sky-like mind and considering the consequences, another way of looking at that is actually what awareness is. I think if I was asked to encapsulate what awareness is, I would say that it consists of two things, really. One is an openness, and the other is a curiosity and interest. So that you're noticing what's happening, you're curious, but you're not caught up in the process. And the practice of awareness is a fundamental practice in Buddhism. It's one of the first things we teach, we try to communicate. We use it in all sorts of ways. And it's a very powerful tool. We even use it in helping people with depression. I've done a couple of courses with Shubha, where we've been working with people with depression. And the focus on that course is just bringing awareness to what is going on without getting caught up in it. And it's very simple practice, but it's not easy to do. But it is very powerful. And Sangharakshita has said, one of his aphorisms is that mindfulness or awareness is revolutionary. And I think that's very true. I think that it's possible to become enlightened just simply by practicing awareness. So, I'm running out of time here. I want to just mention Vajrasattva. In fact, this is also Vajrasattva weekend. You did a puja yesterday was Vajrasattva day. And Vajrasattva is very closely associated with death. You chant Vajrasattva mantras to when someone has died, for example. And I felt, particularly because Vajrasattva is my own personal practice, I wanted to bring this in to the talk. And in a way, Vajrasattva represents a way of approaching spiritual death and rebirth. And of course I can't go into the details of the practice for lots of reasons. But I just want to pick out three things that are present in the tankers, the images. We haven't got any, have we? Yes, we've got a rupa. So there's Vajrasattva. So many of the things you're probably familiar with, the meditation, sitting cross-legged, so on, I can't say too much. But the three things are just things that I think help us with this process of transition from death to rebirth. The first is that Vajrasattva is white. The colour white is very closely associated with Vajrasattva, the white cloth on the shrine. And white represents purity. And you can read visualization practices of Vajrasattva, and they all have this. You go through this bit where you imagine Vajrasattva and nectar, white nectar coming from Vajrasattva into you and purifying you. So there's a process. There's a process of purification. So this process of moving from spiritual death to spiritual rebirth. Is a purification process. And I think it's really important to recognise that it's a process. It's a continual process. You can't be reborn until you die. You have to die to something to allow something new to come up. And I know there's that old adage that there are no endings, only beginnings. Actually, I don't think that's true. I think you have to acknowledge that something has to end for something new to arise. But this is a single process, and if we simply focus on the death, then that's going to be frightening. So Vajrasattva reminds us that this process is a continuous process, and it's a process of purification. And purification is great. Secondly, where have I got to? Secondly, Vajrasattva holds this bell, this Vajra bell. Again, there's a lot I could simply say about the bell. But I just want to suggest one thing to you, and that is that the bell, what it might represent. And I was just thinking, what do bells mean to us? And I think for me, to a large extent, Vajrasattva's bell is one or all of these things. First of all, it's a warning. When you hear bells, there's a warning. You know, something's going on. You know, the fire engines, they used to have bells. I mean, they've got sirens now. But the bells, the old fire engines used to have bells. So it was like, there's something coming fast, so get out of the way. It's a warning to sort of prepare yourself. So the Vajra bell is a warning that death is approaching us. We might meet it this next moment. It's also a guide. I was thinking of a bell in the old days before foghorns, you know, the old lighthouses, the way that ships were steered through rocks or through tricky, particularly through fog to harbour, would be a bell at the harbour entrance. So the fishermen coming home would know which direction to go in, through all the mist and kind of uncertainty, which way to go. Just moving towards the sound of the bell would be the way to safety. Similarly, moving towards wisdom, moving towards purification, moving towards enlightenment is a way to safety. And that bell's a reminder of that. It's also a call to prayer. The bell is used in churches, so it's a call to prayer. So it's an urge to practice, you know, now's the time. The bell's ringing in Vajrasattva all the time. So there's no moment when we can't practice. Now is the time. Not tomorrow, not next week, but now. And it's also, when I thought about it, this came to me last night actually, it's actually also a means of unification. It's a way of bringing things together. Bells are rung, you know, in the nation when things happened. You know, when the Second World War ended, all the church bells rang. It's a kind of, it's a way of, the bells symbolise a kind of bringing together, a unification of ourselves, all the different parts of us become, they operate in harmony. And again, I find that a very joyous sort of thought. I'm not at odds with myself, but I'm in harmony. Finally, I just want to mention the Vajrasattva is associated particularly with the time of day, dawn. And this is that moment between the night and the new day. So it's that period of transition. The night, if you like, can represent the death, the darkness. You've probably heard of the long dark night of the soul. That sort of phase in your life that you can experience where just nothing seems to work and it's all kind of gone to pieces. I think after my parents died, it was a bit like that for me. It wasn't just my parents dying, there were other things going on as well. That really felt like a long dark night of the soul for a good couple of years, really, on and off. But there's dawn, and Vajrasattva's there. So you go through the dark night of the soul, you kind of lose the plot, it all falls to pieces. But then it's inevitable with the night that the day will follow, and that's the rebirth. And Vajrasattva is that point at which the transition is happening. So Vajrasattva represents the rebirth, the beginning of the rebirth, and the end of the dying phase, if you like. So, I'm coming to the end. So I've talked about the importance of facing death and the need to prepare for it as well as we can. It might be unexpected, but we can at least be prepared. We need to practice dying. We need to practice dying spiritually. I've talked about different ways in which we resist meeting death and use the example of the five hindrances as a suggestion as to how you could approach this in your life. I've talked about the vision of Vajrasattva as a kind of metaphor for this process of dying and rebirth. And that's just about it. I just want to... there's just two things I want to mention to you. These are quite personal things. And they both speak to me of how I would like to approach death when it comes. And how I try to do it in my daily life when it comes. Not always successfully. The first is William Blake. Many of you probably know William Blake, a famous English mystic, poet. He obviously had a very powerful vision of, I think, what we as Buddhists would call the transcendental. And he spent his lifetime trying to communicate that. And when it came for him to die, he knew he was dying, and he wasn't scared. In fact, quite the opposite. He actually had these visions of hosts, heavenly hosts, that he was going to meet. And he started singing to them. And I thought, wow, I mean, I can't do that. My singing is not good. I'm not able to do that, but I thought, what a way to go. He was just, you know, he was inviting in, he was looking forward to it, he was just full of joy. But I think for me, more personally, my first longest retreat, I went on a weekend retreat, and then about 3 months later I went for a week's retreat over Christmas. I think this one is more me, really. I was on that retreat, and there was a young man there who was really into painting and art and sketching. And he was constantly drawing these skulls. Obviously the Buddhist emphasis on death was speaking to him quite strongly, and he was trying to connect with that by drawing these A3 pictures in chalk and crayon of skulls. And I really liked the way he did it, and I asked him to give me one, and at the end of the retreat he did, which I was really pleased about. Unfortunately, I haven't kept it. I mean, this was like 20 years ago nearly, 19 years ago, and with one thing and another I never held on to it. But I remember at the end of that retreat, reporting in, sort of saying how I'd felt the retreat had been, and I said that this picture that I was given kind of represented how I'd like to approach death. And it was a skull, and it was a grinning skull. But it wasn't that sort of sinister grin that you can get in horror movies and you know, warning signs, you know, here be dragons or whatever. It was actually a broad smile. He was laughing. And I thought, actually, I think I'd like to die laughing. And I think that's, for me, is how I'd like to approach death when it comes. Thank you.